Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Lisa Marie Blaschke in this episode. Lisa is an expert in adult self-determined learning, or hoitagogy, and is a program director at the University of Oldenburg. She has plenty to say about how we can better educate by adopting a hoitological approach. I'm talking with Dr. Lisa Marie Blaschke, who is program director of the Master in Management of Technology Enhanced Learning at the University of Oldenburg in Germany. Lisa has a long history with EDEN, the European Distance Education Network, and she is a renowned expert in the area of hoitagogy, or adult self-determined learning. Lisa, it's great to be talking with you.
Great to be talking to you too, Mark. It's great to be here.
Thanks, Lisa. I can't remember the last time I saw you. It would have been at an EDEN event somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Maybe it was in Italy at Genoa.
Well, Lisa, can we begin with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Sure. My career actually began in industry. I was working within knowledge management and online learning. And I'm originally from the U.S. and I moved to Europe in 1990 to work for a computer software company here in Germany. And the company made the decision to move into the international market. And my role there was really to help them do this. And as we shifted our documentation into an online environment, it was really an exciting time because we were designing an online environment that was entirely based on reusable learning objects. And during that time, we were also hiring a lot of new employees because the company grew from, I think it was like 1,000 people to 20,000 within like 5 years. I think they have over 90,000 employees now. And as I was hiring people, and then I was responsible for the ramp up of many of these people, I was really frustrated with their inability to really adapt agilely to the challenges and the complexities of an environment that was really changing quickly, because you had to be able to adapt to every change. And we had this thing at this company where they really wanted to hire doctors. So these were really, you know, fully educated people. But there were some that would, you know, really hit the ground running. And then there were others that it just took a lot of time and a lot of handholding. So this experience was really one of the biggest reasons I decided to go back to academia, because I thought I could possibly help graduates prepare for the, I guess, the real world of work. And to do that, like, by sharing my experiences and managing global projects and knowledge management and online learning for this company. But I contacted the local university and I asked about this, and I was told right away, you know, well, you don't have a master's degree, so you have to, you know, you have to go back to school before we'll invite you in to talk to our students. So I went back to university and I joined the master's program, the Management of Distance Education and E-Learning, which was an online partner program that was designed by Uli Banat here in Oldenburg and Gene Rubin at UMUC in the U.S. And it was while I was doing that that I was bit by the research bug. Terry Anderson was giving a presentation at an EDEN research workshop, and he just it just really excited me. And a lot of the legends that you've already interviewed for this podcast series, they were part of this program. So it's really exciting for me to see the people that you've interviewed, because many of them I know from my studies and also from my work in EDEN.
Yeah.
After that, I started teaching in the foundations of distance education and e-learning in the MDE program for Oldenburg. And I started to do research, and I was exploring collaborative group work and learning and online learning with my colleagues, Jane Brindley and Christina Walty. And we did a couple of publications together. And when I was teaching, I was constantly challenging myself to find ways to support my students in being more successful in their learning. And really to take responsibility for their learning and relating it to their professional practice. I mean, I think that's probably the most important thing, especially if you want them to be able to use what they've learned in practice. We do this in our program now, and we do it through e-portfolios, reflective learning journals, and really emphasize on getting students to think critically about what they're learning and how they could apply it in professional practice. My first big publication was on the topic of hoitagogy, which is the study of self-determined learning, which you mentioned. And it was actually written in response to a colleague, Ross Paul, Jane Brindley's husband, who said to me, we were at an Eden conference, Jane and I had just won a Best Research Paper Award for our work on reflective learning journals. And Ross said, we talked about hoitagogy and the importance of self-efficacy and reflection and related it to hoitagogy. And he came up and he said, well, what the heck is hoitagogy, you know? And I said, you know what, Ross, I'm going to write you a paper and I'm going to explain it to you. So when I wrote the literature review of the status of hoitagogy in the research in Erodal, I had Ross in my head the whole time. Ross was at the time president of Windsor University. And so I was thinking the whole time, this is who I'm writing for. This is who I'm explaining this to. So I think that really helped me in organizing that piece. And from there, I kind of, you know, moved into hoitagogy further. It really resonated with me and my experience because Hazen Kenyon, who designed it in 2000, they talked about how the current education systems really aren't meeting the needs of the workplace. And in order to do so, we need to approach education from a more learner-centered perspective and let our learners to be self-determined. And after that first publication, Stuart Haza contacted me in an email, and we started collaborating on different works, different writings. We did a book, which is an OER with Chris Kenyon, called The Experiences of Self-Determined Learning. And it brought together examples of self-determined learning in education. And then it was also the focus of my PhD work, which I finished a couple of years ago, where I looked at how social media, how we can use it, its affordances to be used to promote self-determined learning in the online classroom. So during that time, I kept teaching, and then I became the program director for the Management Technology Enhanced Learning program at University of Oldenburg, through the Center of Lifelong Learning. And the program is really built around developing current and future managers in online learning and instructors in realizing ODL, online distance learning, by using technology in their organizations. And I guess now I'm wearing a few different hats. I'm working at University of Oldenburg. I'm also signed up to be a senior researcher at the Duale Hochschule Baden-Württemberg here in southern Germany, working on EU projects. And then, of course, I've got all of my work with Eden, working with them on developing the webinars to help teachers respond to the COVID-19 crisis.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much what a summary, I guess, of my work, what I've done so far. So
fantastic. Now, Lisa, you've had a long publication career as well. And because of your role, your research also goes beyond the borders of hoitagogy. Can you tell us about some of the ideas and themes your work has provided, particularly those that you sense are very pertinent today?
Yeah, definitely. Like I said, hoitagogy is really my area that I've been working in, and it came from my work experience trying to help students adapt to change and innovation in the workforce and really focusing on preparing our students to work in a world where they're going to be lifelong learners. So that's really been my incentive, my impetus to continue working in this field. And of course, it brings in a lot of other aspects. It isn't just the theory, but it's bringing in different practices, project-based learning, experiential learning, portfolios, authentic assessment. And by doing so, I've spread out into different areas. But really, all of it has been about pushing students toward more active learning and not passively consuming information in the classroom. I want to make them more responsible for their learning, and that's what hoitagogy is all about. It's giving learners the agency in their learning path. It's focusing on building their self-efficacy, their self-esteem. It's allowing for failure, letting them make the mistakes, and not punishing for them, and to then feel more confident as they move forward. And so you're really developing their competencies, their capabilities, and also emphasis on reflection, what they've learned and how they've learned it, and the critical thinking and inquiry that goes with that. And because it's defined by the learner, it's promoting nonlinear approaches to learning. So there isn't a standard curriculum that they have to follow. Mm. That hasn't always been an easy approach because it moves students out of their comfort zone. Not all students want to be responsible for their learning. They want us to tell them what to do in order to get the grade. They learned how to do school, and I know this because my kids were the same way. You know, you learn what you have to do in order to get the good grade. And here they get into graduate school, and I'm telling them, you know, you have to make some decisions about their learning and take responsibility for it. And many of them would push back and say, well, no, you aren't doing your job as my teacher. You're supposed to be teaching me. But as they move through the process, a lot of them, many of them, came back and thanked me later and said, you know, this was really the toughest course I've ever taken, but it was also the course where I learned the most in all the courses I've taken because I was responsible for my learning and it motivated me to do more, to explore more, to learn more. So even though students want structure and they want to know how to get the best grade in the course, I think in essence they all do want to learn. So I guess in terms of its relevance, I guess a focus on formative assessment, pushing students toward more self-directed and self-determined learning. I think this is really important, especially now during COVID. We need to understand where our students are, what they're capable of, and just keep encouraging them towards more critical analysis and thinking. And within our little pedagogy circles, we call it moving them through the pedagogy andragogy, hoidagogy continuum, or PH continuum. And you laugh, but a lot of teachers, when I talk to them about this, they say, yeah, this is exactly it, because most of my students are passive learners. And if I want to move them to more active learning, I need to make them more self-directed or help them become more self-directed and self-determined. Fred Garner writes quite a bit about this on his blog. So, you know, if you're interested, you can go look at what Fred is doing.
So Lisa, can hoitagogy be applied to any subject at any level? And if so, what are the sort of things that you would look for teachers to do?
Yes, I think it can be applied. You know, I've given a lot of talks about hoitagogy within different circles. And what happens is I always get someone who says, no, this sounds really good for adult learners. It sounds really good for, this particular discipline, but it would never work in mine. And then I find an example where it does. Or I get people that say, well, children can't do this. It's really only for adults. And then there are examples of where it's being done. So it's all really about the instructor, too, because instructors need to be able to let go of their need to control the classroom and to control their students' learning and to allow their students to do it. A really good example, there's a university in Israel. Shlomo Bach used to be president of this university, and they educate all of the teachers that are in Israel. And after 15 years, he returned to managing programs within education at his university, and he became really enthralled with hoitagogy and self-determined learning because it aligned really well with his perspectives on learning. And so he told his teachers, we're going to try self-determined learning. And his teachers were very skeptical in the beginning. Yeah. But he and his colleague, Amnon Glasner, they continued to move their teachers forward. And the teachers, as I said, initially, they were very skeptical. And then they came back after about 6 weeks of working with their students, all grade school students, and they said they were amazed at how self-determined their students could be and how they could learn. So I think there's lots of pockets of innovation. There's lots of opportunities, but it depends on the instructor to be open to it and to be willing to try new things and to give that responsibility to the learner. So I think the role of trust is very important, empathy, working together with your students to define what your curriculum, you know, should look like. It's not easy. I mean, it's a real challenge to realize it because it does require shifting the control of learning to the learner, and that's time consuming, and it completely upends the notion that teachers have to be in control of learning. And we can only do this so much, of course, within the constructs of our academic environments. And I know Maha talked about this in her interview, that you have, that she does a lot of her work in open education, social justice, and she does it on the outskirts of the institution because of the bureaucratic constraints. And so we really try to realize as much as we can within the context we're given.
Mm. So pedagogy can work well within a formal education framework.
Yes, I've seen it work. A lot of it's being done outside of those formal education frameworks, but more and more, and I think especially with the pandemic, people are shifting. People are seeing that they can give their students more responsibility for their learning, more agency, but it's kind of also been a bit polarizing. Mm. And it does require a real paradigm shift in education.
Yeah. So speaking of paradigm shifts, I understand you're now in lockdown or under lockdown conditions in Germany. What are your observations about online learning and education at the present time under these conditions at the moment? Are we seeing a move towards pedagogy? Are we doing education well in these trying times?
Oh, wow. That's really a tough question to answer because everyone is doing it differently. I hear different stories. I mean, historically, online learning has really been viewed as a deficit model of teaching, even though there's been all this research that shows that, for example, that blended learning can have better learning outcomes than just pure forms of online or traditional classroom teaching. And there was a meta-analysis that was done in the U.S. on this 10 years ago, and there was a lot of pushback from educators in traditional environments to adopt it. But the pandemic has really placed us in a whole other context. And so online learning, we have to have it in order for education to continue and for us to continue safely. I guess you could even say that, online learning has saved education, at least in its current, form. Although some people view the current situation from a restrictive, glasses half full sort of perspective, I try to see it more optimistically. And I think you have, like I said, it's really been a bit polarizing, where there will be people that embrace it and say, okay, I'm going to try this out. I'm going to really use this opportunity. And then there's others that say, well, I'm just going to wait it out until we can get back to the way things used to be. And I don't think we'll be at that place for a while. So I think the people that are embracing it and engaging it with now, it'll be a bigger opportunity for them, or they'll be more apt to influence learning within the classroom. I mean, there's lots of opportunities, and you know this from working in online learning. We give our students responsibility for their learning, and we push them to take more control of it. And we can do this by helping them, have more agency and confidence. And this is what pedagogy is all about. So it's really moving them along this continuum again. And we can do things like more authentic assessment, using e-portfolios, project-based learning, experience-based learning. There's unfortunately still the mindsets that we need to control and to police our students. I mean, Audrey Waters has been writing about this extensively lately. I don't know if I can say this on the podcast, but
you can.
Okay. she calls it cop shit. She talks about, the whole movement with proctoring and plagiarism vendors who are really jumping into the fray. And we're forcing students to sit through hour-long lectures in front of their computers, which, you can look at as another form of policing our students. And it isn't really the best way to engage them in learning. And it's really, it's that whole trust issue again, that we're not trusting our students to learn. We're not trusting ourselves to teach in these environments either. I'm not saying that synchronous doesn't have a place, but really the online learning the online lectures for hours and hours are not going to engage their students. I mean, it doesn't engage me. I don't know about you.
No, I'm a member of that camp as well.
So I do see a lot of that happening. I do see a lot of, the hour-long lectures. You have to be here at 10 o'clock and you sit for two, three hours. But then I also see people that are really grabbing it and are practicing authentic assessment and are engaging learners. And I think as professionals in this field, it's our responsibility to inform and disseminate, even evangelize the opportunities, because there are so many. We've got so much history. We've really got this really rich history to draw from. And educators, many of them are completely unaware of the history of online distance learning. And our online and distance organizations are trying to do this to make people more aware. I mean, we did the Eden Pandemic webinar series, taking a really practical approach to helping educators. But there's so much more that has to be done. I mean, I don't know if you were at the Eden Research Workshop last week that was held online, but they did this Oxford-style debate with Christina Costa and Mar Perez San Agustin. And the question of was whether the pandemic would have a lasting impact. And I think that even though the majority of the people that were there thought that online education would have an impact, the prospect is very real that we'll just return to traditional lecture forms, and people say, well, this was a nice experiment, but you know, it failed.
Yeah, I suspect that will be the case too. I think universities will just learn to mitigate against these sorts of things better. But yeah, I think eventually they'll return back to normal. So the technology is obviously making a lot of hoitagogy approaches quite accessible now too. So thinking of e-portfolios, the ability to upload video evidence, social media, there's a whole new different way now of sharing ideas than what there were in classic distance education times. So is the technology also helping bring hoitagogy forward?
Yes, definitely. I think that is part of the reason that hoitagogy moved into the, it's not really in the mainstream, but it just came onto the radar of many people because of the fact that our technologies today offer so many affordances to support self-determined learning. Now, it isn't autodidactism, which some people have asked me, well, isn't it just the learner learns on their own? And that really isn't it. You have your learning guides, you have your teachers who are, you know, really the gurus, the ones who are guiding you through the learning. And so the technology, though, it makes those opportunities more possible to engage in online learning.
Thanks, Lisa. Well, how about the research you'd most like to see? You've obviously done a lot of work in hoitagogy already. There must still be some unanswered questions, though, or other avenues that you're looking forward to exploring. What would you most like to do with a fairly generous research budget?
Oh, well, I think right now, I mean, just in the times of the pandemic, and I think what's really critical, and I think pretty relevant, is building communities to share best practices and approaches. And teachers, you know, they've been abruptly pushed into online learning, and we need to show them examples and to share these with each other and to learn from each other. And so I think if I were to have a budget, it would be, first of all, to create these communities where people could share their examples and of how they've used the pedagogy more and maybe less of the technology, and to really move from more instructor control to learner-centered environments where, you know, the learner has more agency. And, you know, of course, I want to see more research into self-determined learning. There's been a few researchers who are, have done a lot of work in this area, Tom Cochran, Vikal Narayan, Nicoletta Agonafs, and Joab Matos, Amnon Glasner, Shlomo Bach, Emma O'Brien, Gene Reel, and Fred Gardner. They're just a few examples. Rob Brown did a recent systematic review on hoitagogy, which is really excellent. It was in the Distance Education Journal. But there's really these pockets of innovation, and they're all over the world, you know, where it's being done. And I think this could be conducted on a greater scale and bringing them together in order to have any kind of sustainable impact. I mean, there's one example that's being done right now. It's a project by LearnLife in Barcelona, which is led by Christopher Pomerening and Stephen Harris. And they have this ambitious goal of realizing self-determined learning around the world. They want to have a mix of face-to-face and online. And their challenge is really, because they're outside of the traditional education environment, is to get government policymakers and the academy to shift from the more standardized and formalized instruction to more instructor control and learner-centered way of education. And what they're doing also aligns really well with the open education movement. So it'll be an interesting development to follow, and if they're really able to achieve that. And they do have the money behind them, so it will be interesting. And then, of course, micro-credentials, I think, is also really important. And prior learning assessment, there's quite a few EU projects on this. I know through my work with DHBW that we've been looking at micro-credentials and really stacking, you know, the credentials as the student moves along, and the student defining what they're going to learn and when they'll learn it and how they're going to build their own programs. And I mean, George Siemens talked about this many years ago, that our students of tomorrow, they're not going to want to have us really give them their programs. They're going to want to be able to create their own. And I think micro-credentials could be a really relevant part. So I would see, you know, research there as being important.
Yeah, it certainly does sound like an international network. I mean, a few of those names you read out earlier, I do recognize as being New Zealanders.
Okay.
So, Lisa, do you have a favorite example of Hoitagogi in action that you might have experienced yourself?
Well, this is kind of this isn't within the graduate environment, but it's I used to teach English at the local German grade school. Yeah. And I always try to do it in a very, fun way for the kids in order to engage them, because they were a little bit, not as afraid as older students, but it took a while to get them engaged. And so we would sing songs and read books, and then we'd have, little dialogue. And I would always be moving them into pushing outside of their spaces. So some students would be at different levels. So I was always, giving some students harder questions than other students. And one day I came into the class and I had all new books, and I had a plan. Every time I went in, I had a plan on what we were going to do. And I went in and I had these books under my chair, and the kids kept trying to grab the books because we were sitting in a circle, and they kept grabbing the books. And I said, "Now, come on, we have a plan," which is not hoitagogi. That's the instructor being in control. I would let them choose the songs they would sing and the books we would read, but we had a plan. And the students, they kept trying to grab these books. And I said, "Okay, fine." I said, "You take the books. I don't care what you do. We're going to take the last 10 minutes and you just do whatever you want." And I was frustrated because I was like, I'm not getting through everything I wanted to get through. And that's, I think, something all of our teachers face. And what happened when they did this really amazed me, and it reinforced hoitagogi, even though I'm already a proponent of it.
Yeah.
The students were taking the books, they were reading to each other, they were correcting each other. If words were not pronounced, they would say, "Well, that's not how Mrs. Blaschka pronounces that word, that she pronounces it this way." Or they would say, "Well, what does this word mean?" And some of these conversations would happen in English, some of them were happening in German, but there was a synergy in the room that I was really overwhelmed by, because I just thought, wow, this is learning. This is learning happening. And they are determining what they're going to learn, how they're going to learn it, because they've gone and they've grabbed the books and they've decided how they'll learn. And sometimes they worked by themselves. Sometimes they worked in little pairs of groups. But it was really exciting. So that's, that would be one example, I guess.
Excellent. An example by accident.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, can we finish with two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning? One whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise has an important perspective to share.
Yeah, this is a hard question, because
I
went through the list of the people that you've interviewed. Many of them you've already interviewed, was a little bit challenging. I guess in terms of a leader within online learning who has influenced my work would be Bonnie Stewart. She really writes a lot about digital scholarship, experiential practices, and focusing on equity and influence and on critical digital pedagogy. I think she just did a chapter for a book with Jesse Stommel on critical digital pedagogy. So she would definitely be somebody that is influencing my work, because she has a really refreshing perspective on the use of technologies and in education. And the other person would be Asha Kanwar. She's president of the Commonwealth of Learning, and she's got, she's got more publications than I can count, and so much experience in so many different areas that are really critical within online and distance learning, the open educational resources, quality, quality assurance, you know, using technology in learning. And I know she's also talked about self-determined learning within her work. People have contacted me and said, hey, I just was at a keynote and Asha Khanmore talked about self-determined learning. And so that isn't why I think she's great, but no, she's just a woman in leadership that's incredibly impressive within online and distance learning.
Well, Lisa, it's been a real pleasure talking with you. Thank you for sharing your work. Do keep up the good work on Hoidagoji, and thank you so much for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Thank you, Mark. It was a pleasure. Have a great day.
You can learn more about Lisa and her work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.